Please note that the opinions and perspectives shared on the Real Pharma podcast by Nari O and Ian Wendt are their own. These views do not represent the positions, strategies, or opinions of their employers or any other organizations with which they may be affiliated. Now on with the show.
We've gotten to a program that is now the second largest program for drug pricing in the country, bigger than the Medicaid program. This was supposed to be the little tail on the back of the beast. Now the tail is larger than the rest of the animal. And we are in a situation, at least according to my projections, where in 6 years, it will be the largest discount program in the country.
This is Real Pharma, your podcast for real conversations with pharma pathfinders. In every episode, you will hear from an industry insider who has a story to share that goes beyond the headlines. No spin, no sacred cows, no hidden agendas, just stories and the people behind them. Now, here are your hosts, Dr. Nari O and Ian Wendt.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Real Pharma, the podcast where we dive into the heart of biopharma and bring you the stories, insights, and innovations shaping our industry. I'm your host, Nari O, joined by the irrepressible Ian Wendt. Today, we're diving deep into one of the most impactful and debated programs in the healthcare landscape, the 340B Drug Pricing Program. This program was designed to help healthcare systems serve vulnerable communities by offering significant discounts on outpatient drugs. While its benefits can theoretically be substantial, the complexities and controversies surrounding 340B are equally significant. To help us navigate this topic, we have a truly exceptional guest with us today. Joining us is William Bill Sorrell, a nationally recognized expert in healthcare and life sciences. Bill is a retired senior partner from Sidley Austin LLP and has spent his illustrious career specializing in a broad array of healthcare matters. From Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement to pharmaceutical price reporting, from compliance with Stark and anti-kickback laws to healthcare contracts and privacy, Bill's expertise is unparalleled. Bill has been repeatedly recognized by the best lawyers in America and Chambers USA as a leader in healthcare law. He's co-authored several influential healthcare books and has served on key committees for the American Hospital Association and the Healthcare Financial Management Association. Currently, Bill continues to shape the healthcare landscape as a regulatory consultant and a passionate patient access advocate. He's also an educator, serving as an adjunct professor at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law. And recently, he was promoted to the board of the FSHD Society, highlighting his ongoing commitment to healthcare and patient advocacy. With his wealth of knowledge and experience, Bill is the perfect guide to help us unravel the complexities of the 340B program. So grab your coffee, get comfortable, and join us for an insightful conversation. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thank you for joining us. Yeah, this will be an exciting conversation, I'm sure.
So I already mentioned it a little bit in the introduction, Bill. The 340B program is certainly quite controversial, hotly debated within our industry, but also in the mainstream media. And we'll get into some of the details during this episode. But I wanted to just start with, it is currently the second largest drug program in the country. And according to some projections that you shared, it may become the largest in about 6 years, which is really staggering to think about, larger than Medicare Part D. Can you start at the beginning of how did this program come about? What was the intended purpose? And maybe where are we now?
Sure. Well, the great irony is this program began as an attempt to fix an unintended set of consequences that flowed from congressional action. And it has, at least from the manufacturer perspective, and I think from some patient advocates' perspective, resulted ultimately in a new set of unintended consequences, which is not, unfortunately, uncommon. The original situation was that back in 1990, we had the introduction of the Medicaid rebate program. And that, of course, is a program that determines what rebates manufacturers pay to the states, based on a calculation that typically includes a measure called best price, the lowest price to any commercial purchaser in the United States in the relevant quarter. So that, in essence, the Medicaid program is supposed to get sort of the most favored nation price, if you will, that's available in the U.S. Well, originally, when the Medicaid rebate program was developed, Congress didn't focus on the fact that manufacturers had historically given very, very low prices voluntarily to a number of safety net providers that were using those drugs in their own in-house pharmacies to help patients gain access to medications that they couldn't otherwise afford. And so when the Medicaid rebate program was implemented, manufacturers were now in this terrible position. If they continued to provide these discounts, it would count towards best price. It would artificially create a very, very low best price and therefore a very, very high Medicaid rebate. And so manufacturers, I think with great reluctance, said, well, we can't do that anymore. We can't extend those voluntary discounts anymore to those safety net providers. That's unfortunate, but it's the reality. Congress heard both from manufacturers and the safety net providers, oh my goodness, look what's happening. You need to fix it. And the fix was the 340B program. It created a now mandatory set of discount offerings, but in a context in which those discounted prices were exempt from best price. They wouldn't drive a higher Medicaid rebate. And originally, as intended, the program was really just a small little tail on a much larger Medicaid beast. It was just intended to address lower prices for what were probably no more than about 200 hospitals that disproportionately serve the underinsured and the uninsured, and a number of clinic-type providers who focused on the uninsured and the underinsured in a very substantial and clearly delineated way. And that's where we started. From there, as you said, we've gotten to a program that is now the second largest program for drug pricing in the country, bigger than the Medicaid program. This was supposed to be the little tail on the back of the beast. Now the tail is larger than the rest of the animal. And we are in a situation, at least according to my projections, where in 6 years, it will be the largest discount program in the country.
So maybe just to add some numbers of what we're really dealing with, the five-year growth of the 340B program from 2018 to 2023 was 129.4%. And just last year, it grew 16.5%. So these are huge growth numbers. And with this trajectory, it's easy to see why you think in 6 years it might become the largest program overall. Clearly, that was not the intention, but this is the growth trend that we're seeing. The number of pharmacies that are enrolled in this program has grown from 789 in 2009 to now over 25,000. So an explosion in the scope of this program. So the question really is, as you just outlined, there was a very clear purpose for this program. How did we get to the point where it's now so ubiquitous and arguably the purpose has not been retained? How did that happen?
Well, I think lots of different people would give lots of different reasons. I think from the 340B covered entity perspective, this is consistent with the intent. They take a single line from the legislative history about stretching scarce resources, and they say, look, there's nothing wrong with the program becoming the largest program in the country so long as it continues to stretch scarce resources. And from our perspective, the 340B covered entities would say, we're stretching scarce resources, even if maybe we don't give discounts to patients at the pharmacy counter, so long as we're using this to extend the services we provide in our clinic or our hospital. We can buy another MRI. We can add another OR suite. So that's one vision of whether this is consistent or inconsistent. I personally would say that it is inconsistent, that it was designed to be a relatively modest modification around the Medicaid rebate program, and to have it as large as it is not consistent with the original vision. And for me, you know, whatever the original intent was or wasn't is almost irrelevant at this point. The fact is that it is now what it is. And the question, I think, is for me, particularly as a rare disease patient, is it delivering value? Is it delivering value to the patient? I'm concerned that, as 46 Brooklyn research has said, that all too much of the 340B program is making money off the backs of sick patients. We have a situation where, as part of the same IQVIA report that you were so effectively summarizing before, we are now told that on average, the 340B discount for a drug is 55%. We know from other research that 340B entities may upcharge patients as much as 250%. And we know that given the way insurance benefit designs work, if a patient is asked on a specialty drug, for instance, a rare disease patient, to pay 25% of the negotiated rate, the quote-unquote negotiated rate, when they appear at the counter of that 340B pharmacy, what they're actually paying under that scenario is something above 50%, because they're paying 25% of a hugely inflated number that doesn't actually reflect the net price to the 340B entity. And so that's just not right. It's not right that a patient at the pharmacy counter, particularly one that has obvious financial need, should be bearing the burden of providing these quote unquote resources to 340B covered entities. Now, there are 340B covered entities that have an obligation as a part of their grant, for instance, to provide financial assistance to at least some of their patients. So a 330 grantee, as they're called, has an obligation to provide sliding scale financial assistance to patients up to 200% of FPL, federal poverty limit. That's about $45,000 a year for an individual. Well, that's great. That's about 28% of the U.S. population, but it's only 28% of the U.S. population. The IQVIA report that you mentioned indicates that the profits or the subsidy that 340B entities receive every year now from the program is $56 billion. That seems like a lot of money, where there's only in the case of these clinics an obligation to provide some support up to 200%. It gets worse than that, though. The single biggest category of 340B providers that have access to these subsidies is, of course, the hospitals. And within the hospital category, what are called the disproportionate share hospitals that are said to be serving a disproportionate percentage of Medicare and Medicaid patients. They don't have any obligation, at least under the 340B program, to provide any charity care, not just at the pharmacy counter, but anywhere, notwithstanding their receipt of billions and billions of dollars of subsidies. So that's a source of real concern, and it's seems to manifest itself, unfortunately, when you look at the publicly available figures for hospitals reporting their share of costs devoted to charity care. It's less than 2.3%, which is the average for all hospitals, charity and non-charity in the U.S. So for $56 billion, roughly 60, 70% of that going to hospitals, we get a charity care rate that is worse than the average charity care rate of both those non-charity and charity hospitals. That is a bad deal for the American public.
Thanks for helping us understand that a little bit better, because it's a terribly complex issue. And certainly, I think the average patient that's managing their health and just showing up at the pharmacy to try to get access to their prescription that they need, is not thinking about, nor should they have to worry about all these issues. But unfortunately, they're being negatively impacted through your description in ways that they don't understand. And we certainly know that among the American public, drug prices are a significant concern. And this is something that we need to arguably fix or do better. And I often hear the argument, let's say from the covered entity, the 340B side of the table, making the argument that, well, these discounts, while they're not being passed along, the patient at the pharmacy, they're building capacity, they're building infrastructure, they're offering more services, which I think that's a fair argument, but I think there's some problems too, right? So some of these are for-profit enterprises, and you're essentially using these rebates to cover operationally what a normal company would have to fund on their own. And look, it's a competitive market. I know many private practice and independent physicians that just can't compete in that environment because the reimbursement structure and the rebates that are available to 340B entities make it very difficult for a solo practice physician to compete in that environment. They just can't. And you see them kind of going away, their practices are being bought. There's a lot of consolidation in terms of services, which you can argue is maybe good or bad, but it does offer fewer choices in terms of where you receive your healthcare services. But I think what you said resonates with me, that if we don't see the benefit flowing through to the patient, then what is the purpose of the program? Or is the program living up to the spirit of the intention of the program at its inception? I think arguably it's no, others might disagree. But then is it sustainable? The trends are so dramatic in terms of the number of contract pharmacies, the spend increase year over year, the deeply discounted rates that are putting pricing pressures and economic pressures on manufacturers that could stifle innovation. If you kind of draw the trend line out, which you know you've kind of done here over the next 6 years, where it could be the largest program, at some point it does become unsustainable. And arguably we need to make some changes now to do that. And there's a lot of, and I read your posts consistently on LinkedIn. You're very consistent in providing really insightful analyses of these complex issues. And Adam Fine is another one that I would point out that does a great job there. But among all the different lawsuits and pending legislation that's going on right now, are the correct solutions at least being considered? Are there fixes that we think are heading in the right direction, or are we still yet to figure that out?
Well, I don't think we're focused on the right issues. The basic debate here at present has to do with self-help policies that manufacturers have implemented. Once the program was nearing $100 billion a year, manufacturers, having grown very frustrated with what they perceive as HRSA's failure to exercise either any or at least any effective oversight, decided to develop their own self-help approaches. And primarily to date, that has been a focus on limiting the aggregate number of contract pharmacies, either numerically, perhaps with even a single contract pharmacy, or alternatively, by having claims data requirements that allow manufacturers to peer a little more effectively into whether or not these products actually are being used consistent with the program. 340B entities are enraged by these policies. They attempted to institute a series of alternative dispute resolutions with HRSA based on their complaints. They convinced HRSA to send threatening letters to a number of manufacturers who were among the first to implement these self-help policies. That spawned litigation in a number of federal district courts. Now we have one appellate decision that was largely favorable to manufacturers, two others that continue to be pending sort of inexplicably months and months and months after the oral argument in those cases. That may be something worth coming back to it at some point. And the response on the part of the 340B community has been, okay, well, we're not doing so well here in the federal courts. Let's go to the state legislatures and let's get them to pass state laws that say that manufacturers can't institute these policies, that they have to deliver whatever product we want to have delivered to contract pharmacies, regardless of how many contract pharmacies we have. And six states already have passed legislation that says that. Now, that inevitably has generated its own set of litigation challenges. And so far, at least, the 340B community is doing pretty well in those challenges. But all of those moves and countermoves are about this question of whether or not there's an obligation for manufacturers to deliver product to these contract pharmacies that have some kind of contractual relationship to the 340B covered entities, and without really focusing on the patient, I would say. So for me, the question of whether a covered entity can have 200 contract pharmacy relationships or not, or whether maybe it should only have 10, whether all of its contract pharmacy relationships should be within 35 miles, perhaps, of its campus, or whether it can have contract pharmacies 8 states away, more than 1,000 miles away. All of those questions, for me at least, as a rare disease patient, begins with, well, what's the value to the patient? Are these contract pharmacies in a significant way located in medically underserved areas? Does the patient participate in the discount with reduced cost sharing? Does the patient at least know what the markup is from the net acquisition cost to the covered entity or its contract pharmacy versus the charge that they're being asked to pay 25% of, 35% of, 50% of? None of those questions are being addressed. And I think that's a real problem. How can we get to the right policy if we're not beginning and throughout the entire process, keeping our focus till the very end on what's right for the patient? You said that 340B entities say, well, we are looking out for the patient. We're increasing our offerings. We wouldn't, the clinics in particular would say, be able to keep our doors open maybe if we didn't have these subsidies. Well, maybe that's true. But as a rare disease patient, I'd like to see rare and chronic disease patients get a direct benefit from the program at the pharmacy counter. Look, with $56 billion, it should be possible to give people a benefit at the pharmacy counter and still achieve these other ends.
So, Bill, that's a question I really wanted to come back to. So you are a rare disease patient and your family has been affected. So you have a very personal interest in this, but you're also a lawyer and a legal specialist in this topic. On the face of it, it should be very simple to say this program was started with a very narrow and specific purpose to let patients benefit from pricing discounts. Why is it so difficult to align on what the purpose of 340Bs are now in this day and age? Because we're seeing all of these unintended consequences that you mentioned earlier. Why is it so difficult to really hone in on what is this program really supposed to do? How is it possible that we have these phenomena where, as you mentioned, you have some pharmacy that's not even in the same state that's part of a 340B covered entity? And maybe you can provide a few more real life examples of how schizophrenic this seems now. But why is it so difficult? Is it the legal language? Is it the lack of specificity? Why did the program become what it is now from a very, very small focus?
Right. Well, I think there are many, many answers to that. I think I would expend all of your time just going through the various contributors to that. What I would say is that probably the two single biggest drivers is that what originally were a very small portion of hospitals. Again, they're 60 to 70% of the program. Originally, a very small percentage of those hospitals actually saw enough Medicare, Medicaid patients in order to meet the definition of a 340B covered entity. Again, the projection was roughly 200 at the beginning. Now it's more than half of all U.S. hospitals. It's more than 2,500 hospitals. So that's been a huge driver. And there are lots of reasons to be concerned about that expansion. You know, you look at the hundreds of billions of dollars that Duke University, one of the universities in the U.S. that has one of the highest endowments, has secured from the 340B program. I just find it hard to understand why that is so. We have a classification in terms of the expansion of different hospital types called a rural referral center. Cleveland Clinic, not located in a rural area, is the poster child for what's wrong with that particular classification. Cleveland Clinic, in fact, receives a huge proportion of its patients through referrals, but only, as I understand it, 3% of those referrals come from rural areas. And yet, as a rural referral center, they qualify everywhere for 340B discounts and subsidies. So the hospital piece of this is very important. I think the other part of it is contract pharmacies, what you laid out at the beginning. I am old. I was there in 1990 and 1992. I worked with manufacturers who had those voluntary discount programs. It was absolutely not the case that a recipient of those discounts at a Texas hospital, for instance, was able to then ship discounted product to a CVS and say, well, that's my product too. That absolutely did not happen. What did happen is that fairly shortly, within 2-3 years of the time the program began, some very smart people on the 340B side of this said, hey, if we could create a contractual relationship with these for-profit pharmacies, particularly with these national pharmacies that are going to grow by leaps and bounds, we would be able to capture a huge percentage of the total U.S. population, and we would be able to secure a huge set of subsidies as a consequence. And all we have to do is share some of that money with those pharmacies that we put into these very large networks. And HRSA said, gee, that sounds like a great idea. And we went through a stage of evolution from a demo program to a guidance, a non-binding guidance that said there could be one contract pharmacy, to eventually guidance that said that there could be an unlimited number of contract pharmacies. And that's how you get from the number you began with to the number that you ended with. So I would say that those are probably the two biggest drivers of program expansion to date.
And that has resulted in some of these things that we see now where you have organizations connected in a way that are nowhere near each other or have any discernible commonality. Is that correct?
Well, it all depends on this question of how you define the patient. And that's another both policy and legal issue. The 340B entities would say, look, if we have had an interaction with that patient for any reason, whether it's connected to the prescription or not, within what we consider to be a reasonable period of time, in the case of the Genesis Clinic, which produced its own litigation on this question, they staked out that 3 years is what we're currently requiring in terms of the lapse between whatever the encounter was and our claiming that patient is a patient. Well, that's obviously a very expansive view. And you could get and will get to a very large proportion of the United States if you use that definition. If you use the definition that I have advanced in briefing in the Genesis case, that the relevant statute begins with a reference to with respect to a covered outpatient drug, meaning that the patient has to be a patient with respect to the covered outpatient drug, then there has to be a real connection between the prescription or the underlying services for that condition that the 340B entity has to be responsible for. And that would be a much narrower, still large, but a much narrower version of what could be considered the patients. So unfortunately, the contract pharmacy issue dovetails with lots of other issues. And that's part of the complexity here. These things are not individual parts. They are parts of a whole.
But I think the pain points from a manufacturer's perspective, there's a variety of them. We've already touched on a couple of them. Some of that, I think, is a consequence of just poorly written legislation that leaves this ambiguity, this vacuum, maybe, that the Genesis patient definition case is a good example of, well, they're just going to fill that vacuum with their own definition that certainly favors them. But the consequences are these really maybe problematic dynamics that exist from a manufacturer's perspective. So I'll just kind of go over a couple of them. There seems to be a high level of resistance among the 340B entities, just in terms of transparency, to make sure there's not duplicate rebates and that these are appropriate patients. It's tough for me to kind of reconcile in my mind why there'd be that level of resistance to just providing the data to be able to allow the manufacturer to reassure themselves that the program is being administered correctly and then they're not being hurt through just what might be honest errors. And I've seen those firsthand, and errors can happen. Sometimes errors can happen because there's lack of transparency and accountability, and nobody's looking at the numbers, which is a problem, number one. Number two, you know, I think that this explosion of contract pharmacies, which I think occurred around 2012, and you can see the massive increase in contract pharmacies. And these became significant revenue line items for national pharmacy chains like Walgreens and CVS. I mean, they were benefiting from, let's say, 15% cost sharing there. And certainly they're partnering, let's say, with a covered entity to capture as many of those prescriptions as possible. But that creates problems as well. Like we've seen cases where, when you highlighted one with Cleveland Clinic, there's been others that are these very urban-based centers of sites of care, but they're claiming to be a rural referral center, which I think is arguable. We see dynamics where there was a covered entity in New York that had a contract pharmacy in Honolulu. And so it's hard to get your head around why that might exist. I suppose if you have a very broad patient definition, then they can make the argument. But it does seem a little bit opportunistic in terms of how they're structuring their pharmacies. And then the location of many of these pharmacies, and of course, patients would have no way of knowing if this is a contract 340B pharmacy or not. But the location of some of these pharmacies are in some of the most upscale, high-income areas in these urban centers. And obviously, they're not serving an underserved population by any means, but it's there strategically to capture as many rebates as they can, whether it's a patient that is underserved or not. And then you still see other areas, maybe within the same MSA or metropolitan area, where it's poorer communities, and they do still have lack of pharmacy services, right? Because it's not about placing the pharmacy that can benefit the most patients. It's about placing the pharmacy where they can capture the most rebates. It's the wrong incentive structure. So these are all things that, Nari, you asked the question, well, why haven't the benefits flowed through to the patient? In my opinion, the simple answer is they haven't been required to do that. And so they won't. Honestly, it comes down to that.
Right. Well, I am sympathetic to the argument that these funds are being used to benefit the patient. The problem that I have is that I also know, since my father was a hospital administrator and a hospital CFO, that if asked what a hospital or any entity does with a particular pool of money, it can choose as it wants any expense item. And there's no check on that. Money is fungible. People volunteering, oh, well, we used it for this purpose, doesn't give me any sense of confidence that in fact is a real window into the way that the money is being used. What gives me confidence and what I think is fair would be a circumstance where the group of patients that right now are bearing the highest burden from the 340B program at the pharmacy counter are the ones that get the first benefit from the program at the pharmacy counter. And then after that, I think there are appropriate uses. Look, the critical fundamental problem behind all of this is that the federal government is not using tax funds to support the safety net of the nation. It's using these manufacturer, predominantly using these manufacturer subsidies in order to effect that governmental end. It feels costless to the federal government. It feels costless to 340B entities. It feels costless to the American public, but it isn't. There's never a free lunch. If there's $56 billion of subsidies coming from an industry, then its pricing and contracting necessarily elsewhere has to reflect that $56 billion. What doesn't come off the backs of sick patients at the 340B covered entity pharmacy counter comes off of the backs of others. It is not a costless program. So it's very true that, you know, 340B advocates, when I have dialogue with them, and I appreciate every time I do have dialogue with them, they'll say, look, Bill, there's a point at which if we don't have, at least in our view, some substantial portion of these subsidies, the safety net will collapse. And what I say to that is, look, we have fought a 30-year battle in healthcare to end cross subsidies, to make individual healthcare services stand on their own. We can't have a $56 billion cross subsidy, maybe in 6 years as high as $140 billion cross subsidy, that is the mechanism by which we primarily finance our safety net. That is just crazy.
We focus a lot on what the pharmaceutical industry says and what the impact on the pharmaceutical industry might be. You just mentioned you're basically just cross-subsidizing this program. But of course, there's also the other side that pushes back on these arguments and says you're getting it all wrong. And you said, look, we are, from their perspective, from the 340B covered entities perspective, we are providing services. Maybe it's not really the rebates, so patients don't get cheaper drugs, which was the original idea, but we do other things. What other arguments are there that we could highlight here that speak for the way that the 340B program is managed currently?
Well, I think you've come to the wrong person, unfortunately. This just seems like a program that is broken. There are lots of reasons for that. We have legislation, which I actually think is clear, but obviously different people are interpreting in a different way. We have a regulatory agency with relatively limited regulatory authority that can't, in many cases, address those issues. Some people, at least on the manufacturer side, would say, well, that's a good thing because they've effectively been captured. As Adam Fine says, they are an example of regulatory capture of the agency, that it's no longer objective with regard to the set of agencies and interests that it's supposed to regulate. So I don't have a lot of faith in the existing program. And I look at things like the SUSTAIN Act, which is a bipartisan legislative effort to try and address some of these issues. And what I see is predominantly a piece of legislation that would put us back into the environment before manufacturers engaged in the self-help they did, which is to say that all of the underlying problems are still there. This is a program that would just grow that much faster as a consequence. So I am skeptical about the ability to fix this. I think that maybe the changes in Medicare Part B could create a window of opportunity. There, obviously, we have the institution of Medicare Fair Price. We have a new 340B duplicate discount program that has to be recognized in that context. And the government has itself said, look, we're going to have this intermediary called an MTF, but that intermediary, at least initially, isn't going to try to do anything with respect to 340B duplicate discounts. We're going to throw up our hands and say, nope, that's not our problem. If individual 340B entities happen to identify themselves, well, we'll pass that information on to manufacturers. Okay, well, that's a recipe for an even greater collapse. But I think there's an opportunity that comes from that. I think that manufacturers, contractors working with those manufacturers and 340B covered entities can rally around the concept of a claims data process and say, look, we all have an interest here. We, the 340B entities, are kind of skeptical that you manufacturers are actually giving us the discounts that you're supposed to be giving us. And under this replenishment model that we have to use, which we can go into if you'd like, we're getting paid on a really delayed basis for our discounts. So we should, I think, as 340B entities, want a system that gives us greater certainty that we're getting the right price and we're getting it quickly. Okay? On the manufacturer side, as you folks pointed out earlier, what they want, I think, at a minimum, is a level of transparency that says, all right, we in fact are obligated to pay these amounts as large as they are. Yes, we're obligated to do this. And I think that a claims data system that could have as short a turnaround as 14 days, if everyone cooperated with it, is a way of answering everybody's fundamental concerns. But we're going to have to put down our swords and we're going to have to agree that on the one side, we're not going to burn this program to the ground. And on the other side, it can't be the case that the program grows by 16.5% a year and there's no mechanism for manufacturers to have any recourse, to have any insight into what's actually happening at the transaction level. So you, the 340B entities, you identify the claims. We, the manufacturers, will have a system in place to analyze those transactions based on the data that you supply within a short period of time, perhaps as limited as 14 days. And the intermediary will give you a level of assurance that this quicker payment that you're getting is in fact the right payment. That's the gist. That's the core of what I think could be a way forward.
I love that idea. As somebody that worries and thinks about this stuff on a daily basis from a commercial perspective for a manufacturer, that sounds wonderful. How do you weight the likelihood of a program like that coming about? Are we partway there? Is this just pie in the sky thinking that maybe someday, somewhere, somehow this could happen? How do you weight that?
I don't really know the answer to that. If you had asked me that question a year and a half ago, I at that time perceived CMS and HRSA as moving towards that point because of the IRA, because of the Inflation Reduction Act. I was hearing even 340B advocates who are table pounders on the other side prepare their audiences for the possibility that that was going to happen. Now, what unfolded after that was that CMS, for whatever reason, got into a position where it could not imagine really implementing the IRA on time. And it started jettisoning program tasks as quickly as it could in order to slim down what it had to deliver as of January 1, 2025. And the very first thing that they decided to jettison was any real role in identifying 340B duplicate discounts. And so I think the question now becomes, under the current guidance, which allows manufacturers to choose sort of two methods. They can either proceed, quote unquote, prospectively under their own system, or they can work retrospectively through this MTF contractor that CMS will have. What can manufacturers do to essentially offer the mechanism that I just talked about, to present it as something that really will deliver faster payment and do so in a way that gives confidence that the payments are the right payments? Can they institute a self-help policy that says that? You know, we will make the MTF available to you. Here is what we need in order to do that in 14 days. And do they have the will to fight the inevitable litigation challenges that will follow from that? My guess is that some will. I think at this point, the problem is so big. I think the problem is reaching the point of being existential. And folks that were willing to allow this program to grow unchecked in 2010, that were suspicious in 2015, are now adamant that they have to take some action, no matter what the litigation risk may be.
Well, you know, I hope you're right. I think it's an issue, or I was going to say a fight, that needs to be fought to get resolution, to get clarity for both sides. I think that's a great point. You can find a solution that solves problems that both sides feel legitimately that they're facing. And to continue as is today is just not sustainable. And I think we didn't even touch on a couple other issues. I'm going to flag up one just because I want to get your perspective on it. There certainly is a scarcity of health care resources, right? There's only so many dollars we can spend. And this is one of these warped incentives that I've seen play out a couple of times here, where you have situations where you have an older branded medication that over time, the spread, the difference between WAC and the ceiling price becomes quite large, and that dictates the amount of rebate that the covered entity is eligible for. So it creates this strange incentive structure that I'm not sure supports patients. I'm not sure this has been fully explored. On the one hand, you have newer medications that may come out, and maybe those newer medications offer advantages in terms of safety or efficacy, but there's less rebate available for a new medication. There's like a 23% probably mandatory rebate on that one. The older medication that's been around for a while that may be used in a high volume setting can be quite substantial to the economics of that site of care. And their rebate might be 50 or 60%. And so there can be a reluctance to move to the arguably better, newer medication because the rebate incentives aren't there. And the other example that plays out even in a more dramatic way is you'll see a branded medication go generic, right? So it goes generic. And of course, by definition, the generic has a lower acquisition cost. So you think that it would benefit everybody to use the generic, which is the same active ingredient. But there can be a disincentive there for certain, this is largely in the outpatient setting, where there's a dependency that's created for the covered entity on the big rebates for the branded product. If they moved everybody over the generic, they would be hurt financially quite substantially, depending on how their structure site of care is set up. And so you have this reluctance to move to a lower cost medication that could result in better, more efficient healthcare resource utilization because they're chasing those rebates. And I'm not sure everybody really understands that. I've seen that play out a number of times, and that doesn't help the patient. It doesn't help us as taxpayers. And we have to figure out a way to avoid that. I'm not sure if that's come into the discussions points that you've looked at, but I think it's one that we need to address.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I blogged on this. There famously was a 340B presentation that presented the generic versus brand issue, just as you've laid it out, referring to the generic as the rotten egg and the branded product as the golden egg.
I remember that post. Yeah, well put.
That's the economics. And it is a quintessential example of the perverse incentives that 340B covered entities have, just as an economic matter. They have every reason to push a outpatient who can be claimed as a 340B patient and for whom they can capture the spread onto that branded product, even though it has a copayment that is vastly higher than the generic, and even though it hurts the system and that patient at that counter. And unfortunately, there is in fact data out there that shows how deliberate this appears to be, where you will see very high rates of branded prescribing outpatient and very high levels of generic prescribing inpatient, where there isn't the markup opportunity. And that's just wrong. That's, in essence, for me, what's wrong with the SUSTAIN Act. We know what a lot of the problems are. There should be conditions of participation that say that a 340B entity's eligibility for discounts is conditioned, among other things, on the fact that it recommends to the patient the least costly, clinically appropriate option for that patient. We cannot have a program that in substantial measure makes $56 billion a year off of the backs of sick patients. That's just wrong.
So, Bill, it's been a fascinating discussion with you. We've only scratched the surface of talking about 340Bs. It's certainly a topic that has captured the imagination of many Americans. It's very hard to explain, really, the complexities of it, but I think you've done an amazing job of bringing us a little bit closer to understanding what this is all about, and most importantly, what a future pathway could look like. Because as you mentioned, there are a lot of issues with it. The system is broken, but here we are. The program exists, and it's just continuing to expand. How can we make sure that we find a better way of administering it and really passing on savings and benefits to patients, which is the most important aspect of this program, or should be? So in your long and storied career, has there been a person or an experience or a motto that has really shaped what you do?
Well, I don't know that it has shaped me as much as it should have, but I just posted a little bit of a tribute to my high school geometry teacher. I think it's a window into at least his personification of leadership. I was a precocious freshman. I'd taken algebra in grammar school, and I had designs even then of finding my way to an Ivy League school. As a kid in San Francisco, that was a somewhat unusual fixation. I got into this geometry class freshman year, and because of a variety of scheduling reasons, I was not in the honors geometry class. I was in a class that had a number of students that were really challenged to learn math concepts. And Colonel Gilbert was my teacher. He was a 31-year Army officer. He had started as a platoon commander and subsequently been an instructor at West Point. And he taught for 15 years after his retirement from the Army in the little Jesuit school that I went to for high school. I have never been more frustrated with a teacher in my entire life than I was with Colonel Gilbert, because he would not move on from one lesson to the next until the slowest student in the class had understood the lesson. And since I was trying to get into honors pre-calculus the next year, this just enraged me. My blood pressure was just out of control every time I would go into this classroom. I went to my father, who was a staff sergeant in World War II, and I tried to get a sympathetic ear here. And he said, well, tell me a little bit, Bill, about your teacher. And I told him the basics of Colonel Gilbert's background. And my father lifted his bushy eyebrows, as he did when he was about to correct me. And he said, well, so what you want this man to do, who kept people alive by keeping them together, is to ignore that when he walks into the classroom. Is that what you're saying, Bill? And at 14 years old, I rolled my eyebrows and went to my room dissatisfied. The next day, I went into class, same thing, same three students in the back of the class behind me couldn't answer a question about a polygon to save their lives. And I basically exploded in my desk. I was harumphing for 55 minutes. At the end of the class, Colonel Gilbert, as everyone else is filing out, asks me, Mr. Sorrell, you seem displeased. And I said, yes, I am displeased. I'm trying to get into an honors program. We are going so slow. There's not a chance that I'm going to get through that exam at the end of the year. And he said to me, well, what are you going to do about it? And I said, me? What am I going to do about it? I'm not the teacher. Well, Colonel Gilbert said, why haven't you ever tried to lift these folks up? You know the answers to these questions. They're sitting right behind you. Why don't you help them? If you want to move forward, why are you not sharing what you know? So the next day, stunned after that, we went through the same exercise yet again. Same questions, same poor three kids, same non-answers. And then he looks at me, and I turn my desk around, and I say, all right, maybe we should look at page 46. And what I learned is that to be a leader, you have to stop thinking about yourself.
Wonderful anecdote. I love that. Thanks for sharing it. Lesson, I think, for us all to give us pause and something to think about for sure as we kind of worry about our own objectives, but make sure we bring everybody else along with us as well, so everybody can share in success. Thank you so much. This was a great discussion. You know, we took a very complex subject, hopefully made it a little more accessible for the audience to learn a little bit and understand it a little bit better. For those of you that maybe want to do a deep dive on this subject matter, I highly recommend you follow Bill on LinkedIn. You can find him at William Sarail, S-A-R-R-A-I-L-L-E. I think you post daily. I have a hard time keeping up with all of your posts, Bill, but they are wonderful and so helpful. So I highly recommend that. And thank you for helping all of us understand this just a little bit better.
Well, thanks for the chance to speak with you. This was great.
Thank you, Bill. We really appreciate your time. And we'll link to your profile in the show notes as well, so everybody can easily find you.
That sounds great. Thanks again.
Thank you. Bye. Well, great discussion with Bill. Certainly a hot topic that I end up reading a lot about, thinking a lot about for my role. This is something that we need somebody with Bill's expertise to help kind of decode and navigate all the complexities of the program and the ongoing litigation and kind of the wins and losses along the way. It's an evolving landscape for sure that we're all just trying to figure out. I think Bill went a long way to helping us there. But my takeaway is that this is a well-intentioned program that certainly has some good, important elements to provide services, to make those services available and accessible to folks that are either disenfranchised or have lower access to healthcare because of where they live or socioeconomic factors. I mean, those are points I think everybody on both sides can agree to. But the problem is, I think this program has grown beyond all reasonable expectations of the original intent of the legislation. Bill mentioned that it's now the second largest federal program delivering healthcare services, and it will be the largest by his projections within the next 6 years. I don't think anybody ever dreamed that that would be the case when the legislation was first passed. So the argument might be that we need some clarity and some help in kind of reforming the legislation so that it really serves the original intent of the legislation.
I agree, Ian. I don't have much to add to that. It's a program that had a great vision in the beginning, but then the way it's been executed and has grown and really mushroomed is not aligned with that original intent at all. And I think we gave Bill a chance to come up with, is there anything that we've missed in terms of benefits, hidden features? And he said, nope. And that's that. But if anybody else disagrees, I think it would be great. Contact us to have a round two of this discussion, because I think the conclusion from Bill's side was very clear. And it was a very good exploration of this topic that really is in the news frequently, not just for our industry's professionals, but just in the mainstream media too. And that really indicates the extent and the impact of this program at this point. And that will probably, as you said, only increase from now on. So we will have to watch this very closely.
Yeah, and I think to be fair to this topic, we should find somebody on the other side of the table from where you and I sit.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of advocacy and lobbying that takes place on kind of, let's say, the pro 340B side of the argument. I'd love to hear their perspective, because certainly they have a position on why the program is, for example, from their perspective, maybe working just fine and as intended. Our position is probably a bit different, especially when you see situations where literally the covered entity, so this would be like a 340B federally qualified health center, is often making more profit, and this goes for hospitals and outpatient clinics, is making more profit off the medication than the manufacturer is. So it may not be sustainable from a economics perspective for manufacturers to continue to participate. There will be a tipping point. And so better to solve some of these problems now than wait for the system to truly become broken, where it affects patient care, and then we're trying to pick up the pieces. So more to come on this, and we'll find somebody else to give us the alternative view and see if we find any common ground.
Yes, absolutely. That would be a welcome addition to the show to explore this topic a little bit more holistically. And I cannot wait to find a guest who will be able to show us the other side.
We'll make it happen. Once again, a fun, interesting, and engaging topic, maybe a little controversial, but fun to get into, but really enjoyed it.
And that's a wrap on today's episode of Real Pharma. We hope our dose of pharmaceutical discourse has left you in good spirits and has increased your titers of knowledge.
Absolutely. If you found today's pill packed adventure as stimulating as a shot of epinephrine, we'd love for you to show us some brand loyalty.
Yes, drop us a like and leave a review. It's the best prescription for podcast success.
Think of your review as the little booster shot that keeps our show in tip top shape.
And hey, don't just keep us as your secret remedy. Share the good vibes and let others in on our Real Pharma therapeutic sessions.
So hit that review button like it's the perfect cure for a long commute. Your feedback is the treatment that keeps us going.
Thanks for tuning in. And remember, an episode a day keeps the boredom away.
Stay curious, stay healthy, and keep this podcast prescription handy for biopharma stories and insights.
See you next time.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. Please visit us at realpharma.co for more valuable resources. Real Pharma is brought to you by Black Canyon Ventures.